Simon Mercep. We're back with the first international edition of Crave, the podcast about films, music, television, and anything else that's been entertaining me and Steve McCabe over the last week or so.
We'll be talking about Legend, the story of London's Crave twins.
Steve will be taking a look at Straight Outta Compton.
Simon's been exploring Europe's cultural highlights in cities starting with a B.
While Steve's been watching concerts large and small in Auckland.
Films first this week. So, Simon, Legend. The story of East End legends or just glorifying thugs?
Well, they were. Well, it's true, Steve, that they are a couple of thugs, but this is one heck of a story. It's, or at least it's part of the story of the Cray twins, Ronnie and Reggie, infamous gangsters of London's East End in the 50s and 60s, former boxers who owned clubs and ran a protection racket, and built a reputation for being real tough, violent men, which has to be said, this film shows that's just what they were. And it also shows that they liked the limelight. The film's told from the viewpoint of Reggie's fiancée and then wife, Frances, and at the beginning of the film, the twins are already well-established crime figures, and the story goes on to talk of their expansion of their empire, of feuds, of alliances with American gangsters, and eventually of Ronnie and Reggie's fall from power. And Steve, got to say, this film really packs a heck of a punch.
Doesn't it just? What possibly the most remarkable thing from the outset is the fact that both twins, Ronnie and Reggie, are both played by Tom Hardy, one actor taking both roles. And he really does draw a very clean line between the two characters. You've got, on the one hand, Reggie's charismatic thuggery, for want of a better word. At the same time, he really manages to capture Ronnie's spittle-flying madness and insanity. The pair of them were dangerous men, but he manages to find nuance in their danger and their ugliness.
I agree, and it's such a convincing performance, aided with just a little bit of a change to the appearance. One's got the hair slicked back and the glasses, and it looks like they put a bit of padding in Ronnie's suit, maybe. I saw the film, Steve, with someone who didn't get it till I explained it to them, that it was the same actor.
Oh, wow.
Actually playing both roles. They thought it was two different actors. That was how convincing Tom Hardy was, not just not just in the appearance, but in the way he inhabited those two characters. Did a fantastic job.
Indeed. I mean, he captured both the charm of Reggie and the incipient madness and insanity of Ronnie. It was quite remarkable. Of course, it does help that Brian Helgeland, the director and scriptwriter, provided him with a phenomenal script that was razor sharp throughout. The violence in this film is astonishing. You'll see men having their kneecaps shattered with hammers, but you'll be laughing while it happens.
Laughing, sometimes cringing other times, I'd say, but the violence is a really important part of the story, actually, isn't it? Because this is how these guys rose to the level of power they did.
Absolutely. They were gangsters, let's not forget this. But at the same time, there's always been the running gag in England, the Cray twins are a gentleman, they shake your hands before they shot you. They were always portrayed as being charming thugs. And somehow Helgeland manages to capture both sides of that. He doesn't shy away from the horrific violence and the thorough unpleasantness of both men. But at the same time, he's managed to make a very entertaining film out of it.
He absolutely has. Do you think, Steve, I was trying to sort of see how this fitted with all the American gangsters films that we've seen for so long. And, I mean, a film like Goodfellas was always regarded as one of the quintessential American versions of this sort of story. I think this really sits alongside a film like Goodfellas really well.
Well, obviously, when you invoke Goodfellas, you're looking at one of the top organised crime gangster films of all time. It's a phenomenal film. But yes, I think you're right. This really does deserve to be up there. It rather than focusing on a large number of individuals as Goodfellas does, it focuses much more tightly on the Cray twins. But it does a fantastic job of it.
Absolutely. So, Steve, what do you reckon? Would you buy a ticket for this one?
Most definitely. I've seen it once. I'm going to see it again. I thought it was superb.
I would too. I would probably just mention to people, if they're feeling a little bit squeamish, just be ready for some quite full-on violence. But it's very much part of the story. You need to see it to understand how these two guys ticked and what the, and how they achieved what they achieved. So, yep, big ups to this film. Now, another film, Steve, Straight Outta Compton. A film I haven't seen, I'll say that right from the start. I know it's to do with the history of a really important period of rap music in the States. You've had a look at it. What did you make of it?
I'll say up front, this: I've never been a huge fan of rap music, in particular of gangster rap music, which is something that I've always had the sense of being somewhat a, how should we say this, a challenging art form, to say the least. It's an art form that, as far as I can tell, is as much focused on its lyrical content as on its musical style. And the content is not something I've ever found particularly palatable. From what little I've listened in the past, it seems to be focused very much on violence and on demeaning women. It's not something that speaks to me directly. But I went to see the film because I had a feeling this was going to be a major film. And indeed, it's taking enormous amounts of money at the box office. So I went along, and I will be honest, I did, when I got back in my car after seeing the film, download the title track of the titular album Straight Outta Compton, because I did actually want to listen to it again. I've listened to it twice since, and that'll do me quite nicely. That's the extent to which the music engaged me.
Okay.
The story, less so. It's very much a by-the-numbers rock biopic. Three men, even though there were seven in NWA, but only three really get a look in the film. Three men make a record, it's absurdly successful, they go on tour, they're heroes, things fall apart. And we've seen that film I don't know how many times. So it doesn't really give a whole lot that's new in terms of rock biopics. It doesn't really break any new ground there. What it does is it tries to place the rise of NWA within the context of the rampant racism that pervades much of American society, even to this day, and especially in that part of Southern California, of Los Angeles in those days, where being black itself would appear to be a criminal offence. And so in the background, we see, for example, TVs showing footage of the Rodney King beating, the acquittal of the police officers that committed it, the riots that ensued. But there's very little that actually tries to tie that in explicitly with the music that NWA were creating, which is very, very angry music. And it's angry for a very good reason. But even though it would be very easy for one of the characters in the film, let's say Ice Cube or Dr. Dre or one of those guys, to point to the screen, TV screen, and very clumsily say, "See, that's why we're making this music." They didn't even attempt to tie the two in. It was as though the music and the cultural setting in which it occurred seemed almost divorced from each other, which was odd, because what the film ended up talking about more than anything else was record labels and the start of Death Row Records, and then the violence of their owner Suge Knight and that kind of thing. That seemed to be the focus more than the characters who were trying to create music out of the ugly environment that they found themselves living in. And instead we have unchallenged misogyny. In fact, for the first half of the film, there are more lines delivered by naked women than by clothed women. This is not a film that challenges any of the ugliness of its own story. It's not bad. It's not a film I want to see again. It's not music I want to listen to again. But I'm glad I saw it.
Okay, I've got a question. You talked about the misogyny being unchallenged. Does it at least attempt to explain it? Because that's one thing I've always struggled with, that, yeah, those images, the gratuitous sexualized images of women in this, the music videos that accompany these songs. And it's pretty confronting. And do you get any sense of why, how this all came about watching this film?
No, not really. There are a couple of strong female characters. There's a mother and a couple of wives and partners. But apart from that, women are simply things that hang on, things that are there to be used and enjoyed. They are decoration. They can be clothed or unclothed, whatever your preference is. They are there to be enjoyed, and that's kind of what women are for, really, in this context.
Okay, that doesn't help resolve it then. Well, Steve, so I haven't seen this. Are you then suggesting yep. I get a ticket.
I would wait until you can loot one in a riot, quite frankly.
We're chatting about the entertainment scene we have sampled in the last little while. And I've actually, Steve, been lucky. I'm on an overseas trip and I am talking to you right now from Barcelona, or should I say Barcelona, where I've just arrived. And the next time we talk, I hope to be able to refer to some examples of Spanish guitar, which I'm planning on seeing.
Oh, how
reasonably
wonderful. How wonderful.
But I've been in two other cities beginning with B in the Northern Hemisphere. First of all was Birmingham.
Not really a town known for its culture, to be fair.
It was a quick trip, Steve.
Yes, it would
and
be.
Actually, and I only really involved a nice stroll of an afternoon around what I have to say is a very impressive pedestrian precinct in the city. So it was a pretty lively afternoon, lots of people out shopping. I didn't get the opportunity to sample its cultural delights. But after Birmingham, I hit, so to speak, Berlin.
Ooh.
Never been there before. But, well, you know, we do the hard yards here on Crave, Steve. So
You've earned it.
I know. Heroically threw myself headlong into two back-to-back evenings of Berlin nightlife. Let's start off with the first one, which was a jazz night. Apparently in one of the city's better-known venues called B-flat in the rather trendy Rosenthaler Strasse of Mitte. I think that's the suburb or the neighborhood, Mitte. Mm-hmm. This is, we're talking 60s cool here.
Ooh, yes.
Steve, there's a club, only about 20 tables, a bar at the back, dimly lit. What lighting there was mostly red. And the band was called Reich Dur Jazz, which sounds like Empire of Jazz.
Yes.
But we were told, doesn't it? We were told, though, no, this translates as rich through jazz. We've got five guys in their 50s, they look like, and they obviously loved what they were doing. We had Johannes on the cello, Jan on the double bass, Michael on drums, resplendent in a bright green t-shirt. And then two front men, Rudy on clarinet and Gerhard on trombone. And these guys began talking to us all in German, quickly realized all of us almost entirely were English speaking. and they quickly readjusted. So are you much of a jazz fan at all, Steve?
Not terribly, no.
I've got to say, I would also fall into that not terribly no category. And I would go as far as to saying I'm rather ignorant of jazz. And I tend to think of it, I guess, for want of a better word, as at times to me sounding technical and not necessarily that melodic.
No, and possibly a bit self-indulgent.
Just a touch. So I didn't go in there with massive expectations, but I wanted to get a sense of the scene that Berlin was noted for, and certainly the setting did that. And these guys were really into it. They actually wrote most of the material. They peppered their performance as well, as you'd expect, solos. And I thought the drummer called Michael was really good. He seemed to play by feel with his eyes closed most of the time while the others in the band all went off sheet music. So I think that most of the audience possibly were in a similar category as me, as not necessarily being full-on jazz fans, because the biggest round of applause came for the group's interpretation of a standard Smoke Gets in Your Eyes,
okay.
A rather not well-known melody. But, look, we put about an hour's worth in. I enjoyed the scene, the atmosphere. I'm not a big jazz fan, but if you're coming to Berlin to get a sense of this famous jazz nightlife, B-flat, and they do have different bands right through the night, including an open mic night on a Wednesday, I'd really recommend it. So I'd give that a tick, even though I'm not a big jazz fan.
Open mic night at a jazz club sounds frankly terrifying.
Well, apparently it's very popular. Apparently what they do is they forget about the door charge,
mm-hmm.
but they hike the prices of the drinks on the open mic night.
Oh, very good, very good.
Maybe that's to encourage people to come up and have a go. Anyway.
Now, Simon, yeah. you're known for taking part in open mic nights, so is this something that you
That's right. I should have gone back the next night, shouldn't I?
Yes.
But But I was tempted to a different type of entertainment on the Wednesday night.
Oh, yes?
A variety show at a venue called the Chameleon Theatre, and this was a show which promised some sort of a hybrid form of circus and cabaret and variety with a dash of sexiness thrown in, and it all sounded rather exciting. And the packed theatre suggested that many others were just as enticed as we were. I would say there's several hundred there. And it's a sort of a venue with lots of tables and a bar at the back. It's got a real cabaret feel to it. This is the Chameleon. That cabaret feel, I've got to say, Steve, helped in no small part by the appearance in the audience, just a couple of tables away from where I was sitting, by a man in his mid-50s wearing a wig and a miniskirt.
Okay.
And not bad legs, it has to be said. As for the performance itself, we had four young men, three young women, all fit, strong, often not wearing very much, throwing themselves, I mean that literally, into all sorts of gymnastic and artful and I guess circus-like performances, balancing on each other, contorting, lifting, swinging. They used a pole, a trapeze with hoops and hoopla. Now, one of the women, as it turned out, I thought was a dead ringer for Jodie Foster.
Oh, wow.
Somehow to lend itself to the theatrical mood. And there was a bit of comedy and a little striptease there too, so it all added to the mix. Now, if you're thinking, I haven't told you what the name of this act is, there's a reason for that, because they looked German. They dressed in what I took to be a German cabaret style. But a couple of songs, which were sung live, suggested another accent. Now, the name, sure, it sounds German. It's Wunderkammer.
Wow,
Wunderkammer.
The Chamber of Wonders, yes.
Yes, but if that name perhaps rings a bell in our neck of the woods, well, yes, not only when you read the fine print at the bottom of the big poster did you find that the Australian government had helped fund this show. All the performers, when I asked afterwards, are Australians.
Oh, fantastic.
All of them. Well, they've gone on an international tour. They've been all over Europe. They've been through Southeast Asia. But I have to say, I somehow felt just a little bit robbed of the true Berlin experience.
You've travelled half
around
the world.
To watch some Australians.
All the way to Berlin, and you're in the room with a bunch of Aussies. Fantastic.
Isn't it? Honestly, though, if you hadn't read the fine print, because there's only a couple of brief snatches of lyrics and a couple of songs, you really wouldn't know they were Australians. The way they comported themselves made you think, Berlin, of course they're German. How could they not be German? It's only when you look into it, scratch beneath the surface, you realise it was a bit more to it than that. But thoroughly enjoyable, and I'd really recommend you see them wherever in the world they're performing.
According to their blurb on the internet, they are seven performers of unbelievable ability to bend the very fabric of reality. You can't beat that, really. I'm a physicist. I want to see the very fabric of reality being bent before my eyes. I'd pay for that. I'd go to Germany for that, definitely.
Right, so that's some of the entertainment scene I've been catching in Europe in the last little while. This is Crave with Simon Mercep and Steve McCabe. Now, Steve, you've been holding the fort in New Zealand while I've been travelling. What music have I missed?
Well, I've not been to quite such exotic locations as you, but frankly, I think I've been having a pretty entertaining time down here in Auckland as well. I was at the Tuning Fork next door to Vector Arena last weekend to see Holly Arrowsmith, the folk singer. She was all right, but her support act was a chap named Skyscraper Stan. He's a Kiwi who's been travelling the world, and he's finally made it back to New Zealand. And I was absolutely astonished by his performance. He has a band, the Commission Flats, named after an estate in Melbourne where he's currently based. But he was performing just with his cousin, a chap named Oscar Herbig, and the two of them put on an absolutely wonderful acoustic set of tight, snappy, catchy little songs of such absolute joy and passion. I can't recommend them highly enough. They opened with Just a Gigolo, with David Lee Roth's number. And from then on, it was absolutely wonderful. At the end of the show, Stan said to the audience, "Wasn't that the fastest half hour of your life? Aren't we fun?" And there's no argument with that. They were superb. Your man Oscar, the guitar player, plays acoustic guitar like it's an electric. He's a lovely guitarist. And Stan, he must be at least 6.5 feet tall and about 2 inches wide. He's a tall, narrow fella with a voice that does not look like it belongs in that body. He's got a rich, sonorous voice that sings complex and entertaining songs. He's coming back to the Tuning Fork in October with his band. They're going to do a slightly more filled-out show. I believe it's going to be an actual electric show rather than the acoustic show I saw last week. If you can get there, I'd strongly recommend it.
I think I will. That sounds great. I will definitely try to get along to that headline show at the Tuning Fork next month. And Steve, what else have you seen?
Well, I went next door just a couple of days later. I saw a band named Imagine Dragons, who, let's face it, one of the worst names for a rock band I've heard in quite some time. It doesn't work as a name for a band, but I don't care. It was one of the best concerts I have ever seen. I usually have very little in common with my teenage daughter when it comes to music. We usually like very, very different things. She recommended that I get hold of the album several months ago, and I did, and I loved it. And so when I saw that they were playing at the Vector Arena, I made a point of getting myself down there. Phenomenal show. It's hard to pin their music down. There's a bit of art rock, bit of prog rock, bit of modern pop rock. There's a little bit of everything going on. But what they do have is four incredibly talented performers. Their singer, Dan Reynolds, I've not seen a frontman like him in quite some time. He has got an astonishing voice with an incredible range. He sings powerfully, he sings sweetly. The music was heavy, it was rocky, it was soft, it was intricate, it was an absolutely superb performance. One of the best concerts I've heard in quite some time. And listening to the audience on the way out, I'd say I'm not the only person with that opinion.
Have they been around for a long time, Steve? Imagine Dragons.
Yeah, they've been touring for close to 7 years, I think, now. And they've been touring pretty much non-stop. The album that my daughter lent me recently, Smoke and Mirrors, is only their second album. So they've spent more time, I think, possibly working on honing their live act, tightening their live performances, and it's paid off.
Fantastic. All right, Imagine Dragons. And it sounds like they're likely to be on the road again before too long.
Oh, very definitely.
You have opportunities to see them.
And if you get the chance, go. You won't be disappointed.
Apply myself to the task of checking out some Spanish guitar music in Barcelona I can report for you on that next time.
The things we do for our listeners, seriously.
Look, people like to know how dedicated we are, and self-sacrificing too, for that matter.
It's terrible, isn't it? But we appreciate we appreciate the efforts you're making, Simon. We really do. Thank you for that.
Oh, well, not at all. And And as for you in the next little while, Steve?
Next week, I will be taking a look at Rock the Casbah, the new film by Bill Murray. And I've got a few very loud and very nasty heavy metal albums to review in the next few weeks.
Oh, that'll keep you busy. All right, fantastic. Thanks very much. And look, thanks for joining us. I'm Steve McKay. No, I'm not. I'm Simon Mertip.
Okay, let's try the... Okay, I'm going to redo the wrap-up, because if you don't know who you are, then the sangria is really working. Right. Right, and since Simon's got to get his sunscreen on and get down to the pool to snag a sun lounger before the Germans put their towels on them, that's all we have time for this week.
You can email us at podcast@cravepodcast.com.
You can find us on Facebook, or you can follow us on Twitter at Crave Podcast.
I'm Simon Mercip.
I'm Steve McCabe.
And that's what's been entertaining us this week.